Hello, it's Tuesday the 7th of March 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, Mike Robinson. And we're delighted to be joined by Mark Anderson from American Free Press. So Mark talking to us from the US of A. We're also joined by John Devine, assistant editor of Awakening News. And John is going to be speaking to us from Canada. So we're well across the Atlantic.
Yes.
I was just going to say it's almost spring-like here today.
Is it?
Hence my shirt. I was a bit grumpy yesterday, but I decided to just brighten things up today before we hit the real news.
Yes. Okay, well, we're going to begin with the Indictor magazine. This is a Swedish publication. It's run by Professor Marcello Ferrada Dinoli. He's formerly a research fellow at Harvard Medical School. He's the founder and chairman of the Swedish Professors and Doctors for Human Rights, and he's editor-in-chief of this publication. Now, they have published this article, Swedish Doctors for Human Rights Denounce White Helmet's Video, Macabre Manipulation of Dead Children and Staged Chemical Weapons Attack to Facilitate a No-Fly Zone in Syria. Quite a long title, but nonetheless, I strongly recommend you read it. He's saying that an examination of a White Helmet's video conducted by Swedish medical doctors and specialists in various fields, including pediatrics, have revealed that the life-saving procedures seen in the film are incorrect, in fact, life-threatening, or simply fake, including simulated emergency resuscitation techniques being used on already lifeless children. And he's saying that central to the PR campaign and just prior to the Oscar award ceremony, Human Rights Watch had published a retrospective report on February the 13th, 2017, which focused on spurious accounts of chemical attacks on the recently liberated city of Aleppo. They talk about the footage in the aftermath of the attack provided at the time by none other than the White Helmets, and they've got some quotations. Now, before I read out the quotations from the doctors, I will just say that if you do go and look at this article, there's a link to the original video clip there. It is quite a harrowing video, and so I say this with that in mind. So they're quoting, for example, Dr. Leif Elinder, a known Swedish medical doctor, who said that after examination of the video material, I found that the measures inflicted upon those children, some of them lifeless, are bizarre, non-medical, non-life-saving, and even counterproductive in terms of life-saving purposes of children. Then Dr. Lena Oske, a Swedish medical doctor and general practitioner, if not already dead, this injection would have killed the child. Now, she's speaking about one part of the video where a large hypodermic needle is plunged into the chest of what appears to be a lifeless baby. She's saying that intracutaneous injection with adrenaline may be used if other resuscitation measures do not work, especially under precarious circumstances such as in field emergency settings, where safer ways for the administration of medication might be difficult or unavailable, but not in the way shown in the video. In order to perform the injection, CPR must be interrupted and then CPR resumed immediately after, which is not done in the procedure shown in the video. The technique is simple. She describes the technique, and so it goes on. Now, this is quite significant because this is, for the first time, comments from the medical profession itself about the activities of the White Helmets in Aleppo. And so I do recommend that people go and read that and perhaps take it a little bit further with their own so-called representatives.
Truth coming to the surface. This is the important part of it.
Of course, we should not forget Yemen. And let's bring Priti Patel back on screen. Now, she is calling on the international community to improve the global response to humanitarian crises. We've been mentioned this a couple of times over the last couple of weeks because they keep producing little infographics and news stories to try to keep this in people's minds. She's saying that the UK is leading the charge in response to humanitarian crises by stepping up support and is urging others to do the same before it's too late. She said that she's setting out a 5-point plan to deliver a more effective global response to the unprecedented number of crises that the world currently faces. And she's saying that drought and conflict in various countries are pushing families to the brink of starvation and so on. Here's what she said. The world faces an unprecedented humanitarian challenge, and the warnings are growing louder each day. More than 20 million men, women and children face the real risk of dying from starvation in the next 6 months because of relentless war and drought. British people can be proud that their support in saving lives by providing food, clean water, healthcare protection and shelter. The world looks to Britain, she said, in times of crisis to lead the response. While we've stepped up our support, we alone cannot avert these crises. Other countries and international bodies must act. Well, you know, as we've mentioned many times before, Brian, she continues to push out this rhetoric. But of course, everywhere that UK aid money is going is exactly the places that are suffering from these so-called humanitarian disasters. And yet the UK aid money doesn't seem to make any difference. The reason I really wanted to bring this back on screen is just to say once again, keep Yemen in mind, because she is saying that we've got to stop these wars and conflicts on one hand, but on the other hand, she is encouraging Saudi Arabia through her and her government's actions to continue bombing in Yemen. So we must keep Yemen to the forefront of our minds, I think.
Yeah, so we've got Yemen, and of course we've got NATO and principally the European Union ramping up military spending and military manoeuvres in Eastern Europe. So it's all towards war.
Yeah, and as somebody in the chat box has said, UK aid bombs, we could describe them as.
Yeah.
This is nothing to do with aid, and it's all about intervention. And I just noticed before we came on air, somebody sent me over an RT article, talking about the white helmets and sort of what the RT was describing as sort of under the covers funding from them, a special fund that Amber Rudd manages. And, you know, we've got to ask questions about what this money is being used for.
Yeah.
Okay, let's bring Mark onto the program now. Mark, you've published this article in 21st Century Wire. This is, I think, related to your book that's forthcoming on the weaponization of the news. Give us some idea of what you're saying here.
Well, a concise description of this, I hope I'm coming through okay, is that this is about the history of fake news and what I call weaponized news in my upcoming book, Weaponized Media. And the title of this article is Nothing New, Fake and Weaponized News Has Long Haunted Our War-Weary World. And what I'm outlining here as a focal point is the New York Tribune editor, Horace Greeley. And it's interesting when you look back, guys, how the media that we're experiencing today is really a continuation of how much of the media has been since the 1860s. I'm speaking mostly of American media. It's hard to do a comprehensive view of all media that far. But I was surprised to find out just how weaponized and often fake the news was going back at least to the 1860s. And at that time, Horace Greeley of the New York Tribune was instrumental in starting the Civil War, what's called the Civil War. Even referring to the South and the need to fight the South, he said, "We are at war with these pestilent." And he urged heavy and instantaneous blows at Maryland and Virginia at a time when Abraham Lincoln hadn't even totally formed the Northern Army yet. So the press has been at the forefront of war oftentimes. And I also talk about William Randolph Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer battle between each other to see who could get us into the Spanish-American War the quickest. And so the article basically sums up at 21stcenturywire.com, that fake media, pro-war media, weaponized media has been haunting the United States to a very large extent since the 1860s. And this is what I'm emphasizing.
Okay. And let's follow that up with this one. This is CBC News in Canada. And this is a fantastic article, Mark. Trust in the media is sinking, and it's time to act. It's time to act. And this is from somebody called Neil MacDonald. And the point that he's making here is that anybody can call themselves a journalist. Well, this looks like ultimately a sort of reverse Leveson going on here, where instead of sort of recognizing the reality of the standard of reporting by the mainstream media. We're simply going to attack the alternative media, which in many cases is doing a better job than the mainstream media at the moment.
Yes. One of my concerns, and I think you guys share this concern, is that all the chatter about fake news and all these things could end up leading to where we'll create kind of a bar, just like lawyers have to pass the bar. Suddenly there'll be some kind of panel, some sort of standards where to be a journalist, you'll have to measure up to certain standards. And those standards could even be along the lines of opinion and ideology and belief. And so we run the risk of the mainstream media closing ranks and saying, okay, if we're going to sort out who's a real journalist and who isn't, we have to have a approves journalists and licenses journalists. And that's what this Canadian columnist is suggesting here in this article, that like a lawyer, something like that, you'd have to pass the bar to be a journalist, adopt certain standards, adopt a certain credo, who knows, maybe even take an oath. He's trying to separate the wheat from the chaff in favor of the mainstream media. And this might not be a dire threat right now, but it's something we need to keep an eye on. A journalist needs to be that unique person in society that is free of these kind of arbitrary standards and licensing and can devise an independent narrative. Otherwise, lock the narrative into the same mainstream mold and independent journalism would go down the tubes. So this is a snare, a tripwire that we need to be cautious of. The main way to get good journalism is to simply be diligent and do good work and provide independent choices for the news consumer and avoid a licensing process, avoid a standardization process. And it's a cautionary note that I'm sounding at this time.
Yeah. John, let's bring you in at this point. What's the situation in Canada with the sort of, with the so-called alternative media? Is there a burgeoning alternative media, alternative journalism? Is it something which is growing like we're seeing in other parts of the world?
Well, we became part of that group and we tried to make ours grow and we've been kind of feeling around, but we could be doing a lot better. Just want to go back to what Mark was talking about, the history of journalism and whatnot in the book he's writing. Up in Canada, there's a serious question that's got to be asked in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which identified well over 90 violations of Indigenous children and Aboriginals. And that's over the last century. And I'm asking, where was Canada's media for the last 100 years? Is it possible that there was thousands and thousands of Indigenous children killed and vanished, and nobody knew anything about it up until recently? It certainly brings a cloud over the history of our journalism, too.
Indeed.
Well, the children, of course, is a very special subject wherein we are seeing time and time again in UK and over a period of years, such as you're describing, John, that even when individual journalists researched aspects of a case, an editorial decision was made that the story ultimately wouldn't be published. So there is some form of control going on through the media or over the media. And that certainly extends back to newspaper articles going back to the early 1900s and earlier. Agree.
Well, of course, the news media responsible for giving the likes of Tony Blair a voice continuing to do so. This is the New York Times from a couple of days ago. Tony Blair saying that he's against populism, that the centre must hold. He says, outrage is easy, strategy is hard. Outrage provides necessary motivation, but only strategy can deliver victory. And he goes on about populism, rightist populism, alt-right this, alt-right that. Some dynamics are splintering the left too, however, the same types of dynamics. One element is aligned with the right in revolt against globalization, but with business taking the place of migrants as the chief evil. He said they agree with right-wing populists about elites, although for the left, the elites are the wealthy, while for the right, they are the liberals. And basically, he ends by saying that progressives must reach across the party divide, making a virtue of non-partisanship. Those who feel dispossessed within existing party structures should make common cause and do so unashamedly. This is exactly what those of us are trying to do in Britain, who are making the case for staying in a reformed European Union. The politics of the progressive center has not died, but it needs reinventing, re-energizing for the liberal democracy to survive and thrive. We must build a new coalition that is popular, not populist. So he's pushing quite a dangerous idea that liberalism should essentially reorient itself as a globalized, pushing for globalized liberalism in opposition to populism that's represented by Brexit and at least in the minds of the mainstream media, represented by Brexit and Trump. And he's aiming to create what we might call an alt-left. Some people are already using this term in the mainstream media. And so what we're talking about here is continuing to polarize and push people to the extremes. And we're seeing this, I think, with Blair. We're seeing with Obama deploying people in the States against Trump. Brian, we've been warning that civil unrest has been the sort of agenda, the policy that they want to push for. And I think we're seeing this being driven at the moment rather than, and particularly through the mainstream media.
I certainly think that's the case, Mike. And the other thing we can see if we look at from a variety of different directions is the fact that we've got this integration going on of the police and the military, Europol being classic, but we're now starting to see other indications, which we'll have a mention of later in the news today.
And we mentioned Obama there. Let's just bring this back on screen. Because, of course, the anti-Trump message is being driven through the OFA, who claim to be committed to mobilizing and training the next generation of progressive organizers and leaders, because real lasting change doesn't happen on its own. It requires a program. It requires organizing. It requires people like, they say it requires people like you, grassroots people with chapters in neighborhoods across the country. Now, of course, OFA is organizing for action. It's absolutely come out of the Obama 2012 and 2008 election campaigns. It's got the same staff. And Tony Blair absolutely working with Obama on this.
It's a job to know what to say, isn't it?
Well, it is. So, Mark, I mean, what sort of recognition is there in the States that it is Obama? Because it is starting to break out into the mainstream media. But what recognition is there that it is Obama that is driving a lot of this anti-Trump rhetoric at the moment?
There's some. Of course, there's this crisis going on, these allegations that Obama somehow in some way may have surveilled or bugged the Trump Tower and actually listened in on Trump's goings on before he was elected. I don't know how true that is. That's something still being fleshed out. I would say the awareness is there, but it could be greater in as much as this is sort of Saul Alinsky meets the money of George Soros and then moves forward. While we have the fight going on, which is the Koch brothers, the very wealthy Koch brothers out of Wisconsin, they control the right, just like the Soros and that machine controls the left. And then Obama rides that left wing part of that overall machine. That's what the structure looks like.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Mark, let's move on to this one then. In case the big media didn't tell you, March 4th, Trump rallies took place in 40 states, 52 cities. This really is another indicator about how the narrative is being controlled by the mainstream media. But of course, they can't stop the information getting out.
Well, there was under coverage of this. We can't say there was no coverage. But I texted about this article that I posted on my blog, thetruthhound.com. Were telling me that they didn't even hear about it, other than those that were involved directly or indirectly. They said they heard about 40 states and 52 cities having small, medium, and large pro-Trump rallies. The basic idea is that with the media being so generally hostile toward Trump, that voted for him, feel they need to buttress his effort, to undergird him and support him in the face of this media onslaught. It doesn't mean Trump is perfect. It doesn't mean he doesn't have some explaining to do. He can make some missteps verbally and policy-wise. Certainly, there's some things to look at. But this is a populist uprising in a way, certainly a report that the mainstream media has done its best to downplay. And I'm bringing that out to show that there are things that people do and want to do that does not accurately reflect or even report very much. And so we're trying to balance the scales. That's our job as the alternative media, the accurate alternative media, as we hope and try to do. So just trying to balance the scales and reflect reality here, really.
Yeah, okay. Right, let's move on to a fascinating story then. The BBC are driving this story, really. The BBC are claiming that Facebook failed to remove dozens of sexualized images of children from its platform. Now, this has been going on for a very long time. There are many closed groups on Facebook, which are by invitation only, which seem to hint from their names that they are containing this type of content. But the BBC is saying that they carried out an investigation into this. They said that they used Facebook's report tool to notify moderators of over 100 images, which were hosted inside pages explicitly for men and with an interest in children. The images were of under 16s. They were in highly sexualized poses. The Facebook groups had names like Hot XXX Schoolgirls and things like this. They contained stolen images of real children and an image that appeared to be, well, they particularly mentioned an image that appeared to be a screenshot of a video of child abuse. They said that Facebook removed 18 of the images on notification and that they received automated messages for the others stating that the other images did not breach community guidelines. The BBC asked Facebook for an interview. And Facebook's UK Director of Social Policy, Simon Milner, initially agreed. But this was where it gets a bit strange, because he asked for examples of the photos. Now, he is a technical person. He's working for a tech company. And so when he asks for examples of the photos, I imagine that what he meant was, could you send me links to the photographs that you're talking about? But what the BBC chose to do, and it just seems utterly extraordinary to me, what the BBC chose to do was to download those images and send them to Mr. Milner directly. So they didn't send him links, they sent him copies of the actual images. This, of course, is in breach of the Protection of Children Act. It's absolutely illegal, and the BBC should have known that, right? So this article, of course, correctly accusing Facebook of not reacting properly to what happened, but the BBC has also not reacted properly to the situation, and they've broken the law in an attempt to notify Facebook or get an interview with Facebook in order to discuss this. Mr. Milner from Facebook immediately cancelled the interview, and he reported the BBC and also Facebook to the National Crime Agency, because Facebook was hosting these images. He wasn't denying that, but the BBC was distributing these images by emailing them to him, so he was making that point as well. The BBC has complained bitterly about the fact that they've been reported to the police for this situation, but the BBC must have been in full knowledge that what they'd done, they must have been full knowledge that that was illegal. Right. So Simon Milner made a statement. He said, "We've carefully reviewed the content referred to us, and we've now removed all items that were illegal or against our standards. The content is no longer on our platform. We take this matter extremely seriously, and we continue to improve our reporting and takedown measures. Facebook has been recognized as one of the best platforms on the internet for child safety." We can talk about that in a second. It is against the law for anyone to distribute images of child exploitation. When the BBC sent us such images, we followed our industry standard practice and reported them to CEOP, the Child Exploitation and Online Protection Centre. We also reported the child exploitation images that have been shared on our own platform. This matter is now in the hands of the authorities. Now, Brian, I don't know what you think of that, but I find it absolutely extraordinary.
Well, I think what we've got there, Mike, is yet another example of the rank hypocrisy of the BBC, because we can come back to the fact that when we alerted the BBC to the abuse of young teenagers at Oxford and Cherwell Valley College, their reporter was going to report, then said that they weren't going to report. They'd been pulled off the case by an editor after they had spoken to all the authorities, which denied the abuse. And of course, the BBC journalist didn't speak to any of the youngsters that have been victims of the abuse. In fact, the BBC tried to accuse the UK column of controlling those highly vulnerable victims. So that was pretty unpleasant. But my mind is also drawn to the BBC that a few years ago was bigging up the adoption of children under a program called Children Wanted. And basically, they had a catalogue produced by the BBC, which contained facial images of very, very young children. I described it as like a catalogue of puppies. And when we asked the BBC whether these were children who'd been given up by their parents voluntarily, the BBC got very squeamish and referred me to a lady, consultant, who basically said, well, no, almost certainly some of those children had been taken from their parents by the state. So the BBC, a little bit too close to very young children taken away from their parents, failing to report on child abuse. And now they're trying desperately, I think, to get some of the moral high ground. This is hypocrisy.
Well, they've blown that, but also hypocrisy on the case of Facebook themselves, because they're suggesting they are the one of the best platforms on the internet for child safety. I don't think Facebook has been recognised for that. There are quite a number of private groups on there where, you know, sharing of this type of imagery is taking place. I believe that the image that was a screenshot of a video of child abuse also contained an overlaid request for more images of a similar type. So this is going on. And of course, Facebook, the first to jump on, or one of the first to jump on the whole fake news meme. And they said they were immediately going to rewrite their algorithms to try to identify fake news. But I don't see too much evidence, and certainly nothing from Simon Milner's statement, that suggests that they're going to take the issue of this type of material on Facebook seriously enough that they're going to stop presses, as it were, and rewrite their algorithms to deal with this. So, incredible. Of course, this situation going on in Ireland as well. This is the Irish Examiner newspaper following a government decision to lock witness statements into a state investigation into child abuse away for 75 years. Andrew Madden, one of the witnesses to this investigation, considers that this is an extreme action by the government, that it's odd. He said that it's really a personal decision, but 75 years is a lot of time not to publish this. I find it quite odd that the records would be withheld for this long. Well, of course, if what's going on is a cover-up, then it's perhaps not surprising.
Well, it's ideal, because you want people dead. And last night I had a conversation with one of the survivors, the abuse survivors, that's been talking to our British investigation into child abuse, the IICSA. And of course, one of the things is that we're now learning this is going to be 5 years or 10 years dragging on, people getting more and more tired, their memories failing. This is how you conduct a cover-up.
Well, the locking of records is not unique to Ireland, because of course, as we highlighted several years ago now, actually, Beechwood, Melanie Shaw's, the residential home that she was in, the records there have been
closed for 75 years.
Yes,
so this is an exact parallel, and this formed one of many records. So it wasn't just Beechwood that had been closed. A researcher discovered that virtually every children's home in the country had suddenly got these enormous lockdowns. So it could be 50 years, 60 years, 75 years. There's only one answer. We're covering up the abuse of children.
In Canada, they've been covering up the abuse of children. But as well as that, there's a problem with the judiciary and the legal process in general.
Well, yes, the most recent government decided to compensate the crimes of the past, the Indigenous children and whatnot. But we're saying here that the whole idea is not to create any more debt for future generations. We don't have the money to pay for what went on in the past, so we've had to borrow it. And they've launched these See Something, Say Something campaigns. We participated in it. Every time we go to the media, they either don't answer or just slough you off. So especially the CBC, and it takes you into corruption, which now impedes the ability of the police to prosecute pedophiles.
Okay, so this headline from your Awakening News newspaper, The Time Machine. Tell us what's going on here.
Yeah, Mark crafted that, and really what we're trying to do, and I think I'd like to throw that over to Mark because he can articulate it a little better. But basically, everybody, instead of taking the situation to the courts and processing it and finding out what the results are, they let time just look after itself. But unfortunately, it gets caught up with themselves. But Mark articulated it well. If you want to take that over, Mark.
The key point is that nothing is ever dealt with in the present. I hope my transmission's clear here. My computer's a little weird. In other words, we rely on legal precedent so much. So in order to form laws now, we look at how past cases went. And that, of course, has led to a lot of injustices on both sides of the boundary with the U.S. and Canada, where the law of the case long ago becomes the law of the land. And that rules supreme for decades and even generations. That's one aspect of it. We also have not enough judges in Canada to prosecute criminal cases. And so now if a criminal case is not brought before a judge in about a 30-month period, the criminal evidently will walk free. That's another aspect of it. And so on and so forth. When you had the indigenous abuses in Canada, nothing was done at the time that those things happened. And so the media doesn't do anything. The courts don't do anything. The police don't do anything. Maybe they're even implicated in the crime in some ways. And everything is flushed down the memory hole for future generations to deal with. And so debts and liabilities snowball, unresolved, unsolved, unadjudicated crimes snowball and pile up. Everything piles up. Everything becomes more indebted, larger, unwieldy, more unmanageable, and then becomes all that much harder to resolve. And so the only thing in jail in Canada is itself, while the corrupt establishment and the criminals and assorted miscreants are the ones roaming free. Justice itself is the only thing in jail in Canada, oftentimes. Of course, much the same could be said of the U.S., but that's the fundamental bind that Canada is in. And the time machine is a metaphor for always putting things off, always flushing things down the memory hole, never dealing with things in the present tense, like you guys mentioned. Ireland locking away records for 75 years and the Melanie Shaw case records being locked away, allow people to die, allow everything, allow time to just spin away forever and never actually resolve the problems that confront our societies.
Well, that's absolutely right, because of course the child abuse inquiry that's going on in England and Wales, the one that's going on in Scotland, this is all about historical events, as if this has stopped in the meantime, and of course it hasn't.
Yeah, and the other bit we need to mention, of course, is that it's basically only the investigation is only against authorities. So a corporate body, as it were, is found guilty. No individuals actually being taken on and prosecuted as a result of this. So it's the body which is found guilty, which then apologizes, and then there is a meager payout to the abuse victims, pitiful sums of money considering what many of them have been through. And then, as you say, the whole thing drifts into the long grass as if it is not going on today. And the reality is absolutely that the abuse is going on today, and we need to bring the abusers to book.
Somebody in the chat box saying, what child abuse inquiry? And of course, this is a valid point, because not only are they only dealing with historical events, of course, this inquiry is going on and it's being almost unreported.
Almost unreported. But we can report that we found it fascinating that apparently the Royal Sun Alliance and Zurich Insurance Companies are part of this child abuse investigation. We should remember that one insurer was responsible for trying to blackmail a local authority in North Wales to keep quiet when it was discovered that abuse had taken place. And now we've got the insurers sitting in. And of course, they're sitting in because ultimately the risks to them, the financial risks, are vast, particularly if the victims were actually paid realistic sums of damages. For me, that's £1 million for many of these youngsters, because their whole life, their whole working life, has been ruined.
John, let's just bring this one back up because I'm fascinated by this. Judge shortage means some trials taking 2.5 years to be heard. And then this article as well, Ottawa should name more judges for Ontario courts. Where is this shortage of judges coming from? And why, I mean, are people not training for the law anymore?
My belief is that it's the guy who controls his purse strings through the judicial system. It boils down to not enough money. Now, they might come up with another idea, but I mean, what's more fundamental to a society than law and order and justice? And cut the money back and then less judges, and then it all catches up and the criminals benefit from it. That's my viewpoint.
Okay, thank you for that. Okay, so we've been talking about governance and the way we are governed quite a lot. Let's look at more changes which give us a clue to what's going on. So this was being tweeted out by the civil service this morning. Have you heard about our new government hubs? Find out how they're changing the way we work. So that takes you to an article that was published by John Manzoni in December last year, changing the way we work. And what's he saying? The way we work, how, where, and when is changing radically as organizations embrace smart working. Smart working is about making the most of advances in IT and more flexible use of premises to allow better decision-making, faster communication, greater collaboration across boundaries. An integral part of ensuring that we are at the forefront of smart working revolution is the Government Hubs program. These hubs are bringing together multiple departments into one building, Brian. In towns and cities across the country, the Cabinet Office recently announced the location of a new government hub at Canary Wharf. That was it on the tweet there. That is the new government hub. That is Barclays Bank building, which they are subletting. 5,700 full-time staff and public servants from several different departments. The new hub is going to be fitted out with the latest smart working technology. The hubs, he says, will be shared spaces, breaking down silos and encouraging greater collaboration across government. And it was that phrase, breaking down silos, that grabbed my attention. Because, of course, if you have a look at this article on the UK Column website, we're all in this together. The issue of silos is part of this article. Do read it if you want to understand why this is important. Well, let's just bring out a couple of quotes. Julian Middleton had this to say about silos. Many leaders have established their reputation on the in the internal silo environment of their organization. When they extend their leadership role beyond the organization, authority and legitimacy are constantly in question. New leaders need to be confident to legitimize themselves and challenge old ways. They need to develop a leadership style that will enable them to lead beyond the traditional boundaries and constraints of the organization. So that's all about breaking down silos in order to lead beyond authority, Brian.
Yep.
The United Nations Development Group said this about silos. All of us who are working to bring people, teams, departments, agencies and countries together to advance sustainable development are battling organizational silos that prevent us from creating integrated solutions. We are the silo fighters. And Professor John Adair, Chair of the Leadership Studies at the United Nations Systems Staff College in Turin, said that public leadership programs should be used selectively. The chief value is to get managers out of their corporate silos and cross-fertilizing with managers from a wide range of organizations. Recommended programs in this context include those of the Windsor Leadership Trust, the Whitehall and Industry Group, and Campaign for Leadership and Common Purpose. British Council also had something to say about this because they claim that they enjoy an established track record in international development of delivering projects in education, skills, public sector, civil society and justice, working with networks and partners at all levels of society. They support the implementation of positive change and that they also break down silos and bring people from different backgrounds together to discuss the issue of shared interest in working together to find sustainable solutions. You know, the key point here is that this is a fundamental constitutional issue of how we're governed. We have a constitution which is there to place limitations and separation of powers.
Separation of powers. This is a key one. Absolutely. Like, absolutely key.
It's there to put limitations on governments which are sometimes operating beyond their authority, and that has a detrimental impact on the lives of us as individuals. If we subvert our constitution in the way that they're doing by bringing everybody together into one box, working together, covering things up together, perhaps committing crimes together in some cases. This is not beneficial to the lives and livelihoods of us as individuals.
This is the dictatorship, Mike. This is how you build the dictatorship.
An issue in Canada was called the Courts Challenges Program. It was initiated when we wrote the Constitution in the 80s. In 1998, they canceled the Courts Challenges Program. And now the governments, municipal, provincial, federal governments, have nobody, like, unless you're really wealthy, you're only going to launch a challenge. Everybody else sits back and watches constitutional violations. You know, there's no mechanism because you don't have the money.
So that mechanism there was to deal with instances of constitutional violations. Is that correct?
Yeah, I made application over a property issue. We were in the courts for 6 years before we heard a judge where a criminal was only allowed to be in the courts for 3 years, and he's let free. So we made application in regards to the length of time. When I made the application, immediately thereafter, they canceled the program. Right. But I think I was exposing a tip of an iceberg about this land banking scheme that's been going on across Canada for a long time. And instead of admitting to it, they just canceled the program so nobody can approach the courts.
Okay, well, there we go.
Well, we're seeing it. It's what we do about it. And of course, the start is to show other people exactly what's happening and to spread the word. Exposure does immense damage to what they're building.
Yeah. Now, just a quick reminder, tomorrow is the budget 2017. Philip Hammond will be there telling us what a great job he's doing and what's going to happen to us tax-wise and what else economy-wise. But
We've got Justin Walker. We'll be with a team of the British Constitution Group and Parliament. They'll be down at the Green here, just to the south of Parliament at 11 o'clock tomorrow. And there's some very good leaflets being handed out from the British Constitution Group, of which the thrust is the fact that our MPs are completely lying about the shortage of money. They're lying about the creation of money. And of course, none of the MPs will talk about the Bank of International Settlements and how the world monetary supply is controlled by a very small number of people. So if you're London area and can get there...
That's College Green, Westminster.
College Green, sorry. Yeah, it had escaped my mind there. But it's the Red Arrow is the thing. This is usually where the press and the media go. So it seems a good place for the British Constitution to go to hand out leaflets, maybe talk to some of those journalists and see what they do and do not know. And we're also advertising, of course, that we have a huge space now booked for the 22nd of April up in Nottingham to bring people together to share ideas. This is not about sitting, listening to talks. This is about workshops. This is about groups of people getting together to teach each other what they are doing in order to counter this dictatorship that's coming into place. So please get there if you can. Ian Crane will be attending Nottingham, but he's also got his own event, AV8, coming up on the 19th, the 22nd of May. There are only 40 tickets left. So if you want to attend that event, you need to get online and get your ticket booked pretty quickly. But a lot of people saying to us, we understand that something very serious is happening in the UK and indeed many other countries overseas. But what we need to do, what we need to know, is how we deal with it. And that Nottingham event is all about that. It's bringing people together who are out there tackling the authorities. They are tackling the courts. They're out there on the ground. So do come along and join us. Right, let's get on to the subject of serious matters of the continuing demise of Britain's military. We say that Theresa May and Michael Fallon, Defence Secretary, are utterly lying when they suggest that Britain is disengaging from the European Union. We have pointed out that actually there is massive movement towards integrating British armed forces into an integrated EU system, and that includes the French taking over Britain's military, nuclear military systems, and ultimately the Germans will be given the lot. But let's have a look at.
Just go ahead.
I'll just come back onto, I just want to step back one. Here we are. This headline here from the Times, Russian election meddling could be an act of war, says NATO chief. Who is the gentleman concerned? Well, it's General Sir Adrian Bradshaw. And he says that fake news and cyber hacks and political coercion by Russia could be deemed act of aggression by NATO. But as usual, there's no evidence in the article. So this is all rhetoric. There is no substance. And we challenged MP Chris Bryant over this a week ago, still no evidence. So the Russians are to blame for everything, but no evidence. Well, we had a little scoop just before we went live, because apparently the Russians have managed to hack into Michael Fallon's CV. And they've discovered that as Defense Secretary, he's qualified in children's nurseries. This is obviously immensely important if you're going to...
For American and European viewers, of course, kindergarten perhaps?
Kindergarten, yes. He's qualified in kindergarten and looking after very young children. Well, this has been reported back to Mr. Putin, and this is his reaction. He was obviously having a pretty good laugh at that. So I think we can see, if it comes to the crunch, who would you rather have on your side, Michael Fallon or... President Putin? Don't think there's much of a choice. But this is the reality here. This is breaking surface. So we've got Breitbart here saying that the French president is pushing for outside the UK to be included in the EU army. That is slightly incorrect, because it is not a European army, it's integrated forces. And this is the sort of comments. It's saying that the Guardian newspaper is reporting that Brexit will be followed by a push for greater defence integration. There is no Brexit. Well, this is true, isn't it? Yeah. It says the UK, even outside the EU, should be associated with that. So the push is that the UK is part of the integrated EU system. And they've set up a new control HQ, MPCC, which the EU is crowing about. And the UK is already involved in that. And Breitbart also pointing out quite correctly here that the European Parliament is set to establish a small private army to protect the president and politicians. And that army is going to answer only to its own internal administration. Now, your point is, I think it's 56 men involved in this, Mike, was it? It was a really small number.
Well, it was 48 normal bodyguards and 12 special bodyguards for the president of the European Parliament.
Right, but the budget was
two billion euros,
so a lot of that money is obviously going to be spent on expanding that force. So follow this through, and I'll bring Mark back in to comment on this, because, of course, the American... NATO side, very important. European Union approves new military HQ. That was the headline there as a separate headline. And here's Mogherini. Today we decided to establish an MPCC, Military Planning, Conduct and Capability Facility, which will command the EU's non-executive military missions. I was fascinated by that term, Mike. What exactly is a non-executive military mission? It's almost like the boys are off doing what they want to on their own with no executive control. But they've got a certain pride. Mogherini says the EU has a certain pride in the agreement.
Yes.
That they're creating a private army. And this is one of the fields where traditionally we've had in the history of the European Union more divisiveness. Since the 50s, we were struggling in the defence field. It's not a European army. I know this is the label going around. It is a more effective way of handling our military work. No, it's not a European army, Frederica. It's integrated EU defence forces with a treasury and procurement. But the prize goes to the UK column, because finally we're now starting to see larger media outlets catch up with what we're saying. European Union considers plan to take over French-British nuclear weapons for EU defence. Discussions ongoing at high levels within the European Union to assume command of the nuclear weapons possessed by member states. And of course, the only states that have got those weapons are the British and French. And we know that British nuclear deterrent already locked into the French. This is unbelievably serious. I think the problem is, Mike, that we have gone so far down the path of integrating British and particularly French forces that Theresa May, Fallon have got the problem of how they lie to the public in order to achieve separation.
Yes, if you're representing a policy to the public, which seems to be what representative democracy has become, you're not representing the public's views, you're representing other people's views to the public. It's going to be very difficult for them to represent, to sort of take people along the path of a narrative in a short enough time frame, because the deal's already done.
It's already done, and they've got big problems how they report this. But let's bring in Amber Rudd. I found this astonishing. It's an economic headline here from MSN. Pound's fall could affect plans for defence investment, says Amber Rudd. And I thought, why would Amber Rudd be commenting on matters to do with defence? Well, what I was totally unaware of was that this lady is actually chairing the Cabinet Committee on implementing the Strategic Defence and Security Review. So we've got a Home Secretary who can't control justice and policing. And that side of the country is also sitting now as a defence expert. So we've got no separation of powers. And now we can see the policing being drawn into the military arena. We've got it happening in the EU, €2 billion spent on a private army to protect the MEPs. Similar going on here. This is dangerous integration.
Let's just remember once again that in October 2015 at the European Defence Agency, Federica Mogherini and Jens Stoltenberg of NATO sat together and they made clear one of their policy items, one of their policy plans was the integration of civilian and military policing.
Yeah,
and this we're starting to see this here then.
We're starting to see this, and I'll just remind people that Amber Rudd is actually a former JP Morgan banker, so no banking interest there. And of course, she's the same lady that was crowing that Common Purpose guru Cressida Dick had been made head of the Metropolitan Police. So there's something very, very nasty building under the surface. Mark, it's becoming very obvious what's going on to us here in UK. I don't know whether Trump means that some of the Obama administration that was doing exactly the same things is now starting to be peeled back. Can you give us some good news from the stateside?
I don't know that I can give you good news in the strict sense of the word good. I would say the separation of powers in the U.S. is a little better. Certainly what you're seeing here is that Brexit, as you guys have long predicted, is largely a sham. The will expressed last June 23rd was real, but the establishment clearly has no intention of actually disentangling the U.K. from the EU. And if you're not disentangled, there's no way you can be independent of the EU. That's the bottom line. I think maybe in the U.S. we have, again, a little bit more of a military that's not quite so depleted as the U.K. military. The situation is a little bit better if you compare apples and apples. But our task as journalists here is to communicate just how much these sorts of things are going to make it virtually impossible for Brexit forward. And of course, the establishment, Tony Blair, you guys talked about today, they're citing Brexit as this sign of a big populist revolt. It was in terms of the voters, but it's not really in terms of what the voters want. Those results aren't being allowed to come to fruition. And the other part of the populist revolt, Donald Trump, is being bogged down by constant media warfare against him. And I would just add that this claim by NATO and associated powers that Russia's meddling in elections is an act of war is, again, such a misfire because Russia meddled in elections. If that actually could have happened, that means all this electronic voting, all the way the elections are put together are totally vulnerable to any outside hacker, not just Russia. The problem is the inability of the UK and the West to safeguard their elections, in as much as they lie about the Russian meme, the Russian narrative. And the real warfare happens when we're told all these lies about Russia, when we're told we had Brexit, but they're not really going to implement it. It's informational warfare, misleading the people. That's where the aggression is, as they consolidate their power, as they break down silos. The warfare is the establishment against the people, not Russia against the West. That's the huge picture we've got to wrap our brains around.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that, Mark. Do we just end with one slide on Brexit?
No, I think
we've run out of time.
Yeah.
Okay. It's always a great shame that we have to limit the program to some extent, although I'm sure we could do nearly 2 hours on this subject at the moment. But can I say thank you to John Devine for joining us. John, if you've just got a very brief few seconds comment to end, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again.
Yeah, my observation in Canada is that what's not being told to the people by the media is very concerning. We've been in a whistleblowing program, blowing numerous issues, and all we get back is silence.
Yeah,
silence. Okay. All right. Thank you very much, both of you, for joining us today. We'll continue to report for as long as we can. But there is good news. People are waking up and people are now starting to take the correct action. Introduce a bit of humour. The other side's very arrogant, so they dislike people mocking them. That's it for today. We'll be back same time tomorrow. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.